High Desert and the Great American Southwest. I bid you all good evening, good morning, good weekend as it begins, and welcome to this program that covers all the world's time zones ever so well, called Coast to Coast AM. I am its host throughout the weekend. My name is Art Bell. And before we get to this evening's first guest, and we do have one in the first hour, all about biodiesel. And if you've been to the gas pump lately, this will be a big duh for everybody. We've got to have it, and we've got to have it right away, actually, in my opinion. At any rate, we'll get to that in a moment. Just a couple of things. One, my webcam photo this night. No, that is not a new kitten in our household, although Ramona and myself have talked about the possibility of having a kitten, of getting a kitten, and we'd really love to have one. But we have four cats. One, two, three, four cats. And, you know, the cat box already is jumbo size. So we just really, but boy, when you look at this little face now, it's a... It's a picture of a cat who, well, of course, it's kitten, and its entire life is wrapped up in this ball of twine. You know how cats are with balls of twine, right? And obviously, it has been playing with this ball of twine for a long, long time. So long that, like most kittens do, they just fall asleep in place. This little guy, you can tell he was in love, just in love, and he just decided he couldn't do it anymore. He was tired, and he went to sleep on the ball of twine. It's quite a photograph. That's on the webcam. Now, this is much more serious. I have any number of emails from people who watched the Princeton Eggs. The Princeton Eggs are actually just individual computers generating random numbers and then reporting back to the mother hen at Princeton University in something called the Human Consciousness Project. And going back now with a long, honorable track record, these eggs seem to register human consciousness before, this is a key word, before the actual event occurs. Now, the track record is so far better than any psychic that I know. There's something about when something big is about to happen, these eggs go berserk. You see, when these random number generators begin to generate non-random numbers, they start to become non-random. Then the alarms go off, quite literally. The alarms go off. You can see all of these worlds, so-called eggs, on a graph with a kind of a heartbeat sound in the background. And then when things start to go berserk, or maybe that's an inaccurate usage of that word. They don't go berserk. They seem to go berserk from a pictorial graphic point of view, but in fact they're becoming non-random. And that's a reason for worry. Looking back, the number of years the project has been in place, its hit rate is, well, just about cannot be argued. At any rate, if you want to know more about the Princeton Eggs, and it's one hell of a subject, go to Google and put in black box and then Princeton. Black box and then Princeton. And it will take you to an article that will explain all about the experiments being done at Princeton. And the reason I did all this setup is I have a whole bunch of emails. I'll read you a couple. Hey, as of 2130, 16 April 05, the eggs at the Global Consciousness Project are extremely active. Dings nearly every beat, multiple dings. Gongs every 2 to 3 beats. Or this from John. Hey, Art, we're in for some deep doo-doo. I've been monitoring the Global Consciousness Project for about 2 years now, and the beeps and gongs are absolutely off the hook today. So, I don't know. Keep your heads low out there. In a moment, Joe Job is the executive director for the National Biodiesel Board, the NBB, is the National Trade Association representing biodiesel industry as the coordinating body for biodiesel research and development here in the U.S. Its members include feedstock producers, processors, soybean commodity boards, biodiesel suppliers, and fuel marketers and distributors. Joe has been with the NBB since 1997, has served as the executive director since 1999, January of that year. Joe's duties included serving as the principal investigator for the $2.2 million biodiesel health effects testing program. Ha ha. Joe became interested in agricultural, environmental, and energy issues growing up on a farm in central Missouri. Prior to working for the NBB, Joe was a fraud investigator for the Missouri Attorney General's office. So if there was any fraud involved in the whole biodiesel thing, you just know Joe would sniff it out. In a moment, we've got lots of questions for Joe, as you might imagine. This last week, Ramona and myself went down to the Phoenix area in the RV. You know, a big old 37-foot diesel pusher RV that I've got. Most of the time we drive a little Geo Metro around, but we took the RV. And let me tell you, baby, I don't have to tell you, right? You drive, you know. The prices of fuel are becoming scary. Scary individually and scary as a nation, because it will affect everything. Everything you own, everything you use is all transported to you by big trucks with big diesel engines. And so this is a big topic, really big topic. Gasoline, the cost of gasoline, what we can do. Here's Joe Job. Joe, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Art. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm very, very honored to be invited on your show.
Well, we're honored to have you. All of a sudden, this is a really, really big topic because everybody's feeling the shock out there right now. God, it's awful.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And we've been working on energy issues for forever, and we've been working on biodiesel for, you know, over a decade. But it really hits home when those fuel prices spike up, and that's only when it really hits the pocketbook do people really want to think about it.
Well, it's hit. It's hit, Joe. It's here. So people are definitely thinking about it. There's a lot of things that we all want to know about diesel. I had Willie Nelson on the program about 3 weeks ago, and Willie said he's got a series of fueling stations for diesel, and he said the following, that there's no problem with diesel. He said you can take it, any trucker on the road right now, God knows there are millions of them, many of them listening to me, can make their next fill up biodiesel, something made out of soybeans essentially, and they can put it right in the truck with no conversion, no problem, no mess, no fuss, just go fill up and use it like you use your regular diesel. Is that right?
That is true. I guess the first thing it's important to understand is what is biodiesel.
What is it? Soybeans is what we hear.
Yeah. Now, it's not the same thing as just the crude vegetable oil that you would take, go and buy the bottle of Wesson off the grocery store shelf.
Right.
But you take that product, and it can actually be any natural vegetable oil or animal fat. Animal fats, any triglyceride source.
Okay.
Natural oil, vegetable oil or animal fat, corn oil, sunflower oil, canola. We use primarily soybeans in this country because that's our primary oilseed crop. In Europe, the primary oilseed crop is rapeseed oil, which is the same as we know of as canola oil in this country. But you take the vegetable oil and you react it with an alcohol to remove the glycerin. And the glycerin is sold as a byproduct for cosmetics and pharmaceuticals and other industrial chemicals. And the remaining compound is called an alkyl ester. That's a chemical name for biodiesel, and it acts very chemically similar to diesel fuel in a diesel engine, except that it is 10 times less toxic than table salt.
All right, here we go. I want to ask some questions here, one at a time, all right, because it's so important. Everybody's worried about global warming, and so we want to know, how does this biodiesel compared to regular diesel, for example, in terms of what it's going to do to the environment?
Right. Well, what you have to do in order to examine the impacts on global warming is you have to do a wheel-to-wells analysis. And the Department of Energy did that wheel-to-wells analysis. In other words, you look at all of the inputs that it takes to produce biodiesel. In other words, the...
Sure. The cost to produce it, energy and so forth.
Yep, all of the energy costs, all of the fertilizers and all of those things to grow the soybeans and to harvest them and to process the vegetable oil and turn it into biodiesel and use it, all of those things.
Okay.
The Department of Energy did that analysis, and what they determined was that there is an 80% reduction in carbon dioxide compared to regular diesel fuel.
Holy mackerel.
And
80%.
And carbon dioxide, of course, is the primary greenhouse.
Yeah, that's right. So 80% less.
80%. 78.9%.
That's very serious indeed. So it's environmentally friendly compared to what we have now, is the true answer.
Yes.
What about human health in general? We talked about the environment, the air and the atmosphere and all the rest, but what about human health? We've all been behind diesel engines that are kind of dirty, and they smell awful.
Yes. If they've been behind a school bus, you know, all those school children are up in there, and the school bus is just billowing black smoke, and you can't hardly drive behind it.
Anybody who drives knows what it smells like.
Exactly.
So how would this be different?
Well, there are a couple of primary differences. First of all, that diesel fuel that's in that school bus has sulfur in it, and biodiesel essentially has no sulfur. And the second thing is biodiesel it contains oxygen. It's about 11% oxygen by weight, whereas diesel fuel is just a straight hydrocarbon. It has no oxygen, and that the presence of oxygen causes it to burn more completely and combust more fully. And so the result, when you burn biodiesel in a diesel engine, is that it creates less of those particulates. That's what you see in that black smoke.
What about horsepower? What about efficiency for the engine? Are the engines going to be every bit as powerful as they are now?
Yeah, well, pure biodiesel is very comparable to number two diesel fuel. It has slightly less energy content to number two diesel fuel. It has more similar to number one diesel fuel.
Would I notice the difference if I put a tank of bio in my RV, diesel RV? Would I notice?
You would most likely not notice a difference. You might notice a difference in fuel economy, perhaps up to 7% difference in fuel economy.
Meaning more or less?
Less.
Less. Oh, 7% less. Oh,
less.
That's interesting.
If you're using pure biodiesel, but most biodiesel currently is being used in blends, and the most common blend is a 20% blend of biodiesel with 80% petroleum. And the reason for that, there's a couple of reasons. First of all, the 20% blend, because biodiesel is an alternative fuel, it is more expensive currently than conventional petroleum-based fossil fuels, because, you know, if you find...
Tell me, maybe you know why, but diesel used to be much less than even regular gas.
Mm-hmm.
And then it surpassed regular gas, and damn if its price isn't headed toward, the more expensive gas. So what's up with that?
Yeah, it is a very strange thing that I can't explain, other than it does flip-flop. Most people believe that it is always it's always been cheaper, but it does flip-flop because diesel is somewhat of a seasonal fuel. In the summer, more people are traveling, they're using more gasoline, people are taking vacations or getting out on the road or, you know, going to Yellowstone Park, whatever.
Yes.
In the wintertime, they're gearing up for Christmas, which is a very large chunk of our commercial distribution, gearing up for Christmas. All of those diesel vehicles are out there firing up. They're using a lot of diesel fuel. Plus, at the same time, They're using a lot of diesel fuel as heating oil, particularly in the Northeast.
Huh.
And
so it's just supply and demand.
It's supply and demand, but typically diesel fuel has been less expensive. But right now, it is more expensive than gasoline, which is a strange anomaly, and I don't know why that is.
I don't either. But we all suspect the worst. That is in terms of, I don't know, dirty, rotten dealings on the part of the oil companies that are raping us. So at what price level is diesel profitable? I mean, is there a price point as the price of gas and number two diesel goes up, is there a price point where biodiesel becomes even more attractive?
Yes. First of all, in terms of the comparison to diesel and gasoline, one thing, you know, most Americans don't really have a very good, the general public, the U.S. general consuming public, doesn't have a really good concept about diesel technology. Most people think in terms of gasoline because their personal vehicle is a gasoline vehicle. Only about 2% of Americans drive a diesel vehicle, which is
that right?
Which is unique because
did you say 2%?
2%.
2% of Americans drive diesel. That's incredible. All right, look. Again, I've got this RV that's a diesel pusher, and I can tell you there's no difference between diesel and gasoline in terms of the way a vehicle performs. Period. Except the diesel gets better mileage than the gas engine.
Right. And it's unique to America because Europe, for example, it's different country by country, but on average, more than half of the cars on the road are diesel.
In Europe?
In Europe. And the reason for that is because the fuel cost is higher. It's significantly higher. At the pump, it's euros per liter, but it's translated into dollars per gallon. It's sometimes $5 a gallon.
$5 a gallon.
So
people, you're telling me people switched because it is better mileage and they've got such high prices they can't afford not to do it?
Exactly. Fuel efficiency is much more important there, and a diesel engine is 30 to 50% more fuel efficient.
I know. Yeah. It's astounding. Well, why have we not followed suit in America? Just because our prices haven't been that high or they've been artificially low or what?
No, it's because American consumers have a very long, stubborn memory for failed experiments. And if you recall, back in the 80s, there was a failed introduction of diesel cars with the Oldsmobile cars. That they took a gasoline engine, they converted it to diesel, and it was horrible. It was stinky and smoky and smelly, and you had to plug it in.
All true, but now we've got the Mercedes diesel, right?
Exactly, but that failed introduction, people just, you know, the word was out, and it still lingers today that you don't want anything to do with a diesel car because it's just bad. But
God,
yeah,
I thought the opposite.
Well, you know, you might poll some listeners and see what they think. You know, people that are not very familiar with diesel, there is a stigma to diesel cars. It's that same stigma that everybody knows, you know, following that same black, smoky school bus.
Oh, sure.
And there's a stigma on performance because the diesels were very slow and doggy, and they were just awful. But diesel technology has dramatically improved.
Well, if it's so, you know, it's not so bad, obviously. I mean, the whole thing's a stupid myth. All of our truckers drive diesel, or almost, the high 90 percentile drive diesel? 100%. Okay, there you go. They all drive diesel trucks, so that's what moves our goods across America. How's it get better than that?
Yeah, well, that's true. But the passenger cars right now, before this year, if you wanted to buy an American-made diesel vehicle, you had to buy a three-quarter ton pickup which is what I drove for the last 5 years, is an F-350 pickup with a Power Stroke 7.3 liter engine. Just absolutely loved it. But they do have, Mercedes has been offering diesel cars since the, well, since the late 60s, but in a very high-performance vehicle since the 80s. I have one now, an 87 Mercedes-Benz, a right. little four-cylinder, and gets 37 miles to the gallon. It's wonderful.
All right, Joe, listen, we're coming up on a break, so hold on a moment. Listen, I'll tell you something else. Diesel engines will run two or three times as far before they need maintenance as a regular engine. So what's the matter with people anyway? The truckers know what's going on. Why aren't you four-wheelers out there getting smart? Demand diesel engines in your vehicles. If the American people want it, they'll get it.
What will you do if you're lonely? No one waiting by your side. You've been alone, I love you long. You know it's just your foolish plan.
Talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
As you know, I'm a night owl, and as a good friend of mine says, that evil, God-forsaken sunshine. You have to be a night person to understand that point of view, but he's a pretty funny guy. Jim is his name, and he loves the same shift that I love, and that's the all-night shift. I heard him talking one night about he has to get asleep before the sun actually starts to come up, before that first little evil sliver of sun slips through the slats and defiles his room. He sounds like Dracula or something, doesn't he? Anyway, he's funny to listen and talk about it. I drive at night. I'm a night driver. I stay up at night, and so if I drive all night long and arrive before the first evil sliver of sunshine, that's just great with me. And being out on the roads, the highways, the major interstates, 40, 10, you know, those kind, I would say 90% of the traffic easily is 18-wheelers. I mean, there's just gazillions of them out there transporting everything that you walk into a store and buy. Everything. goes by road. These guys are out there, and believe me, they're out there in force at night. Thousands, millions, and millions and millions of gallons of diesel is required. So whether or not the American people have grasped the significance of having a vehicle that has a diesel engine, it doesn't matter. The truck industry grasped it long ago, so there's plenty of market for diesel. Trust me on that. We've got an expert on it, Joe Job, with the National Biodiesel Board with us, and he'll be right back. Stay right where you are. Remember, everybody, we're not talking about some future science fiction dream. We're talking about right now. You go to a station that has biodiesel, you can fill up your truck and use it just as you would have used the regular diesel, every bit as good, 80% less harmful to the environment, much less harmful to human beings, smells a whole lot better, and there's simply no reason not to do it. Or is there, Joe? In other words, forget the four-wheelers for a minute. The big trucks are all using diesel by the millions and millions of gallons, so the market is ready now.
Right. The biggest reason not to use it, Art, is it costs more. And the other thing is...
Oh, no, wait. Stop right there. What do you mean it costs more? If I fill up with biodiesel compared to number two diesel right now, how much more?
Well, it differs. It differs by, you know, volume purchased and region and what the product's made out of. But
give me some kind of average, some idea.
Yeah, it's really tough to say, but I'll take a swing at it. There are a couple of state incentives that are going on this summer, for example. The state of Minnesota has passed legislation that by this summer, 2% of all the diesel fuel sold in the state of Minnesota will be biodiesel. So it won't be any more expensive in Minnesota. In Illinois, truckers are using it because they are giving a state sales tax exemption on biodiesel blends.
Really?
So blends over B10 are actually selling cheaper than diesel fuel. But
I come back to where we started. You said more expensive. How much more expensive by the gallon?
Most of the time, biodiesel is going to be a little bit more, it ranges so much, but let's say B20 might cost anywhere from less expensive to, you know, let's say 10 to 15 cents per gallon more expensive.
Well, that's still significant.
Yes.
Now, let's track along here. If the price of regular diesel and gasoline continues to rise, which it's going to, I wrote down before I started the show my own question. At what price level does biodiesel become profitable, become competitive and profitable?
Yes. Well, biodiesel is becoming, as diesel fuel prices rise, biodiesel is becoming more and more head-to-head cost competitive. You know, when I started with the National Biodiesel Board 8 years ago, we were doing testing and demonstration. We tested biodiesel in every diesel engine type and every diesel engine application, more than 50 million successful road miles. And so we were buying it to do testing with. And I was paying routinely $6 a gallon. And at that time, diesel fuel, bulk wholesale diesel fuel, was about 40 cents a gallon. This is bulk wholesale diesel.
This is back during an early testing phase.
This was back during the late 90s. During that, you know, in that same time period, diesel fuel, bulk wholesale diesel fuel, has more than tripled.
That's right.
Biodiesel, there's been... a number of biodiesel production facilities go into place. So now, rather than specialty ordering biodiesel, you're seeing it distributed by tanker truck and rail car and barge. And,
right.
And so biodiesel is getting less expensive, and it's closing that gap.
The other thing is, Joe, and the reason I'm so anxious, and I know the reason Willie Nelson is so anxious, you know, he's been a friend of the farmer for a long time, Joe, the American farmer. And the American farmer is on kind of hard times. But on the other side of the coin, the American farmer is the most efficient farmer, probably, or one of the most efficient in the world. We have a wonderful farming industry. And a fuel like this that comes from the ground would be one hell of a boost for America's farmers, right?
America's farmers, absolutely, definitely. But America's food consumers and Americans in general, because it's going to help the economy. When you crush a soybean, you get 80% protein meal and 20% oil.
Huh.
The protein meal is used for food and feed, and the oil is used for cooking oil and salad dressings.
There's a good deal.
And it's somewhat of a byproduct.
Or in this case, fuel.
In this case, fuel. Well, there's been three economic studies done in the last 2 years, independent studies that have been done. All of them conclude a couple of very important things. One of the very interesting conclusions is that the increased utilization of soybean oil for biodiesel will allow the meal portion of the oil to have to absorb less of the value, while the oil portion of the soybean is absorbing more of the value. So what happens is the meal will actually be sold as food and feed. The meal will actually be cheaper to domestic livestock producers and as food and feed in international protein markets, while the oil is then used for biodiesel, and it increases the manufacturing sector and decreases imported petroleum, which is our single largest component of our national trade debt.
Joe, big question. If we made a sudden move, if America made a sudden move to biodiesel, are we equipped agriculturally now in America to produce sufficient amounts?
Well, we will. I won't say never, but it is unlikely that we are going to be able to completely displace all diesel fuel out there.
I didn't say that.
Biodiesel.
I didn't say that.
Okay.
But if we made a very large switch toward biodiesel or blends, whatever, is our agricultural situation ready to handle that much production?
Yes. Well, it depends on how much production you mean, but the agricultural sector is responding to the market right now because we are in a vast era of growth. Last year, Congress passed and the President signed a biodiesel tax credit, first ever tax credit for biodiesel that is similar to the ethanol tax credit. And that has gone into place, and our manufacturers, there's about 20 biodiesel manufacturing plants nationwide. They are spitting out as much fuel as they can produce right now. There are more plants going into place. There are two 30 million gallon a year plants going in Minnesota alone, and there's about 20 going in nationwide. The market is responding to that. Agriculture is responding to that. And agriculture will and can and does have agricultural shifts and an agricultural response. And if we continue to use more and more biodiesel, agricultural responses can take on the result of shifting to more higher oilseed crops, for example.
Joe, I wonder what it'll do for the, for example, the soy market. I wonder if the soy market will go berserk, realizing there's a sudden call for lots of soy production. Is soy suddenly going to be a much more valuable commodity, meaning a better life for the farmers? I'm really interested in that.
It will, and soybeans are already facing, and the soybean market and soybean farmers are already facing a lot of threats because Brazil is going, they have almost unlimited potential to put more and more and more acres into soybeans, competing with U.S. soybean markets. And they are, and imports, soybean imports, both the oil, the meal, the whole beans, and the processing, are all, you know, increasing from Brazil and South America, but primarily Brazil, but all of South America. And there are other threats in the edible oils market that are threatening the value of U.S. soybeans and U.S. soybean farmers, and biodiesel is offering a tremendous opportunity to hedge those threats. You know, some of the discussions about trans fatty acids and some of those other things, biodiesel is offering an opportunity to hedge those threats to U.S. soybean farmers.
All right. How much does the cost, the current cost of biodiesel, have to do with its limited production? In other words, if production were to crank up on the national level to the area where I think we all would hope it would, wouldn't that also bring the price, tend to bring the price down?
Yes, it absolutely would. What we're moving to, what we're likely to move to in the coming years, beginning next year, diesel fuel, on-road diesel fuel, and all your listeners out there that are truckers already know about this, because truckers are, I have, in my experience, truckers are very well informed, and they know their business.
Yes.
Your trucker audience out there knows that beginning next year, there's going to be a 97% reduction in sulfur in diesel fuel, in on-road diesel fuel.
Right.
And that is that's what's going to create a tremendous opportunity for biodiesel, because the refinery process to remove that sulfur also removes the lubricating characteristic of the fuel, because a diesel engine, diesel fuel injection system, relies on the fuel to keep its rotors and seals and gaskets and pumps all properly lubricated.
Right.
Well, because that removal of sulfur also removes lubricity, most of the diesel fuel is going to have a lubricity additive added back to it. Biodiesel is highly effective as a lubricity additive. 1% biodiesel can improve lubricity by as much as 65%.
Wow.
It is very likely that what will happen is, as we move forward into the implementation of ultra-low sulfur diesel fuel, biodiesel offers an opportunity to blend at the 157 refineries that we have right here in the United States, put it in at 2 to 5% blend levels, move it throughout the pipeline system, the distribution system. It's completely seamless, and we have the opportunity to, in the very near term, to immediately displace up to 5% of our imported petroleum for diesel fuel use.
Yeah,
there's really no other alternative
that is
positioned that well to do that.
Got it. All right, listen, Joe, question. You were a fraud investigator for the Missouri Attorney General's office, so you look at the... I'm sure your mind still tends to look for the holes, for the catches, for the... You know, fraud's a strong word, but I mean, you know, if there's something wrong with an idea like biodiesel, it seems to me you would have sniffed it out and found it by now.
Yes, one would hope that I would have. And, you know, really, the magic about biodiesel is it works. It works, and it really is as simple as we say.
No catches, Joe, that you found, really?
You know, there are strengths and weaknesses to everything, you know, right? It comes down to economics. As it becomes more and more economical, and, you know, customers have to use it, people have to use it. But, you know, people get excited about it when they first learn about it, because they think, this is so great, why have I heard about it before?
Yes.
The truth of the matter is that Rudolf Diesel, Dr. Christian Rudolf Carl Diesel, who invented the diesel engine, and he exhibited his first diesel engine in 1900 at the World's Fair in Paris. It was running on peanut oil. Most people don't know that.
Mr. Diesel.
Mr. Diesel himself, which, you know, I know, Art, you are never one to turn down a mysterious story, but Dr. Diesel was found floating in the English Channel. That's how he died.
I'm not surprised.
Died a very mysterious death.
I'm not surprised, not for one second. You don't think that was as threatening then as it would be now? Sure, it was threatening. The oil companies probably, we thought the oil would keep coming from the ground forever. In fact, you know what? There are people today who think that the oil wells, the oil, this is the truth, Joe, that, you know, the oil that we pumped out of the ground is being magically replaced by
right.
Mother Nature. Have you heard that story?
I have heard that theory, and it it's pretty ridiculous. Everyone knows, everyone that has seriously looked at this, the National Geological Survey, the Department of Energy, and all of the world's, the preponderance of the evidence is clearly mineral oil. Fossil fuel is a finite resource. We know that we're going to run out of it, but what is not known, what there is not general agreement on, is when. Estimates are anywhere from 40 years out to, you know, we could be declining and reach peak oil production, you know, in the very near term. Some
or
people
we may have already. Yes, we may be at peak oil right now.
Yeah.
Meaning the second half of the oil, still a lot left, is going to be a lot harder and more expensive to get out of the ground, hence the prices keep going up.
Right. And so there isn't agreement on when peak oil will get here, but there is agreement that it's going to get here. Peak oil production will get here. And even if it's 40 years out, you know, my children are going to be faced with what to do. And so it's a question of whether we want a hard landing or whether we want a soft landing. And we darn well better start doing something now in order to figure out how we're going to transition. Because energy is, you know, it is right up there with agriculture, the food that we eat. Agriculture is so very important. If you don't have food, you don't have much else. Energy is just like that, because if you don't have energy, well, then you don't have food, and you don't have an economy, and you don't have anything else. And so, and the environment, so biodiesel is something that impacts all three of those: energy, environment, agriculture. It impacts them all in a positive way, which is the reason that I'm so proud to be able to work on something like this.
Joe, and I'm proud to have had you on the program. I wish you nothing but the best, and I think that is the best for America, so I'm going to pray that it all goes well. But I think that the natural course of events ahead of us, Joe, will ensure, trust me, that it's going to go well for biodiesel. And I want to thank you for being on the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Art.
Take care, buddy. And I really meant that. The events unfolding before our very eyes every day at the pump, those will ensure that biodiesel is going to be a big thing in our lives. Another possible big event in our lives is happening in Africa right now. It's called Marburg. It's one of the most horrible diseases known to mankind. We'll talk about it with Dr. Ronald Klatz coming up next. I'm Art Bell.
Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from East of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From West of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is escorting you all through the weekend. How you doing? It's a beautiful one here in the desert, kind of a clear, cool, high desert kind of night with the stars blazing out there, completely clear. Just ideal. What is not so ideal may be coming up. Of course, he's probably the world's leading authority in the new clinical science of anti-aging medicine. And so normally he's a very, very optimistic guy, doctor, actually. For over a decade now, Dr. Klatz has been integral in the pioneering exploration of new therapies for the treatment and prevention of age-related degenerative disease. He is the physician founder and president of the American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicines, Inc. Dr. Klatz is highly regarded by scientific and academic colleagues for his continuing medical education lectures on the demographics of aging and the impact of biomedical technologies on longevity. A consultant for the biotechnology industry and a respected advisor to several members of the U.S. Congress and others on Capitol Hill, Dr. Klatz devotes much of his time to research and to the development of advanced biosciences for the benefit of humanity. So there's the outline of a very optimistic guy. And normally when he's on the program, he is very optimistic and very excited about the ability of science, the increasing ability to keep us alive for longer and longer and perhaps ultimately even indefinite amounts of time. But he may not sound quite as optimistic tonight because we're going to discuss kind of a different thing with Dr. Klatz, although I'm sure we'll certainly touch on anti-aging. The news on Malberg is not good. Malberg is a terrible... We will describe the disease in some detail and its current outbreak in Africa. Some are very concerned that it may be or may be about to become airborne, which would be a nightmare of the first most dire degree. So coming up in a moment, Dr. Ronald Klatz, stay right where you are. Perhaps I'm easily frightened. I don't know. But last week, I read to all of you, and there have been many stories since, a couple of stories about Marburg, which has broken out now in Africa in a very terrible way. Two stories. The second story concerned the possibility that it may become airborne, or perhaps already has become airborne. And they were saying that healthcare workers who were using precautions, you know, standard precautions, were coming down with this killer disease. And killer is an understatement indeed. The mortality rate of this particular strain of Marburg appears to be up around 92 to 100%. I mean, it kills you. That's all there is to it. But let us begin at the beginning. Dr. Klatz, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Art.
Ebola, doctor. Americans have heard about Ebola and now Marburg. They're similar. Can you describe, for example, the Marburg virus, what we know about it, what it is, and what it does?
Well, it's a relatively new virus. It's a rather rare virus. There's only been a few outbreaks in history. It was only discovered, really not that very long ago. Marburg, I believe, was first identified in 1967.
Okay.
And this is a hemorrhagic virus, hemorrhagic fever, like Ebola. And until recently, there's only been a few outbreaks, and it's been relatively small numbers. I think the largest number up to this point was about 130 people who contracted the disease. And already, it's now pushing, I think, 235 is the last number that I've seen.
Are you talking about in this current outbreak?
In this current outbreak, right. So
all
this
right.
is the largest of them all. But, you know, people do know about Ebola, I think, because it's gotten so much attention, because Ebola is such a killer disease, Ebola being 90% fatal. Well, Marburg seems to be doing a better job than Ebola now, and that's kind of strange because in the past, Marburg outbreaks were about 30% fatal. And so this new...
Exactly. Exactly. Excuse me, let me interrupt. Geraldine in New York says, "Hey, Art, please ask Dr. Klass why the mortality rate of the current Marburg outbreak is so high. As of 4:15, the mortality rate is 92%. Every site I've seen has lower mortality rates, including the CDC site, which says 23 to 25%. But sure enough, we're hearing this particular, is the right word, strain?
I think that's the right term, yeah.
All right, this particular strain is killing somewhere between 92 and 100% of the people who get it. My God.
Yeah, it's not pretty, it's not good news. And, you know, one has to wonder how this virus has changed so rapidly, or is there something even more nefarious at work?
It's not a good way to die, is it?
No, it kills you. Well, there's really no good news about it, but I suppose if you had to put it in terms of not the worst news, is it kills you quick. You know, the disease does lead to, has a rapid onset and a rapid, rate of killing, and, people will die within a few days to a week. And the good news of that is that viruses that are that lethal tend not to spread as readily.
Usually because they burn themselves out. They kill their victims before their victims can spread.
Yes. Now, the problem with the Marburg virus is that this particular virus is spread by contact with body fluids, but the body fluids can be not just sweat or saliva or urine, but can also be droplets from a cough or a sneeze.
Oh, my
and
God.
That's how it becomes airborne, and that is not a good thing.
So would you then officially classify this as airborne? Is that what this means?
I it's not to me to classify these things. I'm not really, I'm not in that particular specialty of infectious disease. But, you know, from all intents and purposes, if you can spread this by droplet infection, which is a sneeze will do it, it'll kill you as quick as, somebody... giving you a deep kiss.
Well, look, I know that, scientists and doctors don't like to concern people, but isn't this just semantics? I mean, if you can do it with a sneeze, that's the same way you spread, I don't know, the flu.
The flu or tuberculosis or any black plague.
So these stories we've been getting of the doctors and the nurses who have been using taking the normal precautions around Marburg victims,
mm-hmm.
they've been getting sick.
Well, there have been a number of them who have died, I believe. 12 healthcare workers is what I've read.
Right.
To give you more accurate numbers, as of from the World Health Organization on April 14th, they report that 224 cases, that's actually a correction from a previous report of 235, cases and 207 deaths, but that's still very, very troubling numbers.
That's horrible, and that doesn't mean that those are left will not die. It doesn't obviously break down the conditions. Maybe they
no,
just...
And there's a long recovery to this as well. I mean, it really does wreak havoc with the internal organs of the body, the pancreas, the liver, So, you know, this is not something that's going to be so wonderful to recover from either. So just because it didn't kill you doesn't mean that you're scot-free. So
if you're lucky enough to be among the 1 or 2 or 5% that doesn't die, and that's your odds are horrible. I mean, so if it does kill you, laying it right out on the table, what happens to your body? What does it do?
Well, these are hemorrhagic fevers. These viruses get into the bloodstream, and they cause a consumption of the coagulating factors in the blood, the platelets, the things that keep you from bleeding to death. And in fact, you do bleed to death. The organs start to bleed within themselves, and people will actually bleed through the eyes, the rectum, through their skin. I mean, it's not a pretty sight.
God, so you're saying that's what it does, is take away the clotting factor in your blood? Is that the extent of it?
Well, that's just part of it. It also attacks other organs as well. But the reason why it's called a hemorrhagic fever is because you essentially bleed to death from the inside out.
So number one, it stops your ability to stop bleeding, and number two, it causes you to start bleeding.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Yeah, not a good scenario. And this bug has to be contained. I mean, and
how rapid is the onset?
It can be an incubation time of 10 days, or it can be sooner.
It's like the flu.
Very much like the flu.
Does anybody yet, doctor, know what the vector is? In other words, this Ebola and now Marburg, this more dangerous Marburg, seem to, I don't know, it's like they come out of some secret hiding place. And it hits, and then they have what we have going on in Africa right now, and then it burns itself out and goes away, and then months or even a year later, boom, it comes back. Where is it hiding?
Well, they know that it can be carried or it can be transmitted through green monkeys. Now, green monkeys are kind of interesting because green monkeys are one of the favorite research animals used by virologists and other infectious disease researchers in Africa. But they don't know what other vectors are involved.
Well, as sorry as I am for those in Africa, and I'm sure most Americans would join me in this, I read this horrid little novel recently, which actually was, I'm afraid, quite good. And it was a scenario in which, in this case, there was a horrible outbreak of something not even as bad as Marburg in China. And a couple of Al-Qaeda terrorists went in and got blood samples, and they went away to a secret little location and started culturing this crap and set it loose. Well, that would seem like a valid worry with respect to Marburg. I mean, for example, if somebody got a Marburg sample of the current Marburg in Africa and let it loose in Chicago,
it would not be pretty. It seems to be this new strain, and one again wonders how it went from a 23% fatal lethality to its current 90% plus lethality.
Anybody have any thoughts like you?
But, well, it would seem to be a very good candidate for a biological weapon, as you suggest.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe someone is playing around with it. As a matter of fact, chances are very good many someones are playing around with these sort of things. And certainly it's been suggested in some circles that, many of these infections that we're seeing now, including West Nile virus and even AIDS, was in one way or another due to some either research or weapon research or biological experiments that got out of hand. Now, again, I just want to make it real clear for your listeners that my background is in biotechnology and biomedical research, and I am not a specialist in infectious disease. And, I'm happy to have this conversation, but I don't want to mislead anyone to say that I'm giving you any deep inside information. I know as much as other physicians know who read medical websites and who are plugged into CDC mm-hmm. and the World Health Organization, other groups like that.
Mm-hmm. When I spoke to you the other day on the phone, I heard what is usually a very optimistic, forward-looking guy sounding kind of depressed. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
Okay, Art. Yes, I suppose we could say that, yes.
I just picked this story up tonight off MSNBC.com. Headline, two shipments of deadly flu missing, WHO says. Let's see. I haven't even read this myself. Health experts have destroyed two-thirds of the specimens of a killer influenza virus sent as part of a routine test kit around the world. But we're still trying to trace two shipments that were supposed to go to Mexico and Lebanon. In other words, they're lost. The World Health Organization has been urging thousands of labs in 18 countries which receive vials of the nearly 50-year-old H2N2 virus to please destroy the samples amid fears of a global pandemic should the virus be released. Now, this rises to the top of the I can't believe it scale, the whole thing.
It's a major oops. And one has to wonder if it's really an oops or if it's a, you know, or if there is something a little bit more malignant behind it. First of all, why would the World Health Organization, through laboratories in the United States, by the way, this all came out of the U.S., why they would send to 4,000 different laboratories a virus sample. Originally, these virus samples were supposed to be used for calibrating viral laboratories around the world, so that, you know, to test them to see that they had adequate proficiency in detecting, you know, one virus or another.
All right. I want to be clear on this. In the story, it says they sent the killer influenza virus as part of a routine test kit.
Yes.
Now, that implies just what you said, but it shouldn't have been the really horrible form of have been this virus at all, right?
No, they never send pathological viruses as part of their test. These are innocuous viruses that that they send as part of their test. And it's interesting that these supposedly, and again, you know, my sources are the internet just like everyone else.
Yes.
But supposedly these not only did they send this previously killer virus out, but it was mislabeled as something else entirely. And it was only by accident that it was discovered at all. If it wasn't for a laboratory in Canada, in British Columbia, that had contaminated the lab with some material, including this material, it never would have been found out. It was total serendipity that this was even discovered.
And if it hadn't been discovered?
Well, we still don't know what the long-term sequelae of this thing is. I mean, because certainly, it's not just two labs that have not returned the samples or have lost their samples. There's still a third of those 4,000 labs that have not, you know, checked in yet. So who knows how many samples it could be. But if it was not discovered and people did not take adequate precautions with this material, it's very possible that it could have escaped the laboratory, created a new outbreak of influenza that would not have been, you know, recognized initially, and could have been could have spread quite wide and quite far. This is the Asian flu that back in 1957, the Asian flu was responsible for 1 to 4 million deaths worldwide.
Wow.
So what this means is that people do not have anyone who was not around in 1957 has no immunity to this stuff.
Well, I remember hearing that on another program, and I wanted to ask, those who were born previously to 57, how many of us would likely have immunity?
People prior to 57 would probably, there would be, it's kind of hard to say. Generally, 10% of the population will come down with the influenza in any one year. But in a pandemic, an influenza outbreak that strikes a large percentage of the population is a killer virus. Generally, it's more than that. Maybe as much as 25% are exposed to it.
Doctor, hold on. Dr. Ronald Klatz is my guest, and we're discussing once again the little things. But it's the little things that can get you. I can't fathom how they could have sent that out. I can't fathom it. Can any of you out there?
Talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
The new strain of Marburg, nearly 100% fatal, and it's a disease that virtually causes you to disintegrate, gets rid of the clotting factor in your blood, and then disintegrates your organs, and you bleed to death. Everywhere it's horrible, and it appears to be a new strain in Africa, a particularly deadly strain. We'll be right back with Dr. Klatz. Once again, Dr. Ronald Klatz. Dr. Klatz, I think I said pretty dramatically, you know, I cannot fathom, in my wildest dreams, I can't fathom how something like this could get sent out worldwide in a test kit. First of all, it would take so much of the virus, it would have to be an awful lot of the virus in the first place. I mean, you know, I'm sure we keep samples of deadly viruses around on a routine basis. In fact, I know we do. Even the 1918 is held somewhere or another. But do we manufacture gigantic amounts of it, enough to send out to labs all around the world?
Well, apparently so. And, you know, this is not an innocuous virus either. This is not, a heavy containment virus. I believe it's a bio-level 2. But it still is a pathogenic virus. So, I mean, it wasn't like it just... it was just sitting around the lab somewhere.
My question is why would we have it under any circumstances in such quantity?
Well, I don't know that the quantity is tremendous that would need to have. You'd only need a really, viruses are so small that a few grains of, equivalent of a few grains of sand.
Okay, but thousands of labs in 18 countries. That's
yeah,
still...
It's a little piece, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's very, very troubling. You see, there's a lot of things that are very troubling, and I guess that's why I was depressed when we talked the other day, or sounded depressed anyway, is there's a lot of strange stuff going on in the world, Art. And if you're looking, if you're a futurist like I am,
Yes.
And I know you are. You know, if you're looking to the future and you're looking to a bright future and you believe, as I do, that, you know, things get better generally all the time, and the technology just makes things better all the time, you know, whether it be your TV set or your, internet connection or, you know, or your health care, and that we're looking, all of us, at least all of us baby boomers, are looking to life expectancies of 100 years of age and beyond, you know, this kind of bad news with regard to global warfare, with regard to biological warfare, with regard to infectious diseases that are coming, springing up like mushrooms after, a summer's rain, make you scratch your head and go, what is going on here? You know,
all right, there are two possibilities.
One case of Ebola could ruin your entire life extension program.
There are two possibilities. One is nature, and that because the world is so populated now and we have so much adjacency to animals, I don't know, I'm reaching here, but one possibility is nature is generating these increasingly horrid little viruses, and the other possibility, of course, is that man is taking them into the lab, sequencing them, and figuring out how to make them even more horrible, and then testing them. Which one do you lean toward?
The trouble is I just don't know, and I wish I knew. And if anybody really knows what is going on out there, I would really appreciate it if they give me a call. I promise to keep it all very confidential. But, I'm not sleeping well at nights these days because I just don't know. And the world is getting to be a very strange place because straightforward things that you would think, you know, should be done with regard to limiting pollution, with regard to energy, with regard to global peace, they just don't seem to be happening.
All right. Let me cast another hot coal on the fire of suspicion here. There are a lot of people, Doctor, beginning to keep track of the seemingly unusual number of biological experts getting murdered.
Oh, yeah.
Or dying very suspiciously.
Yes.
A lot of people are keeping track of this. 50, yeah. Is it 50 now?
I believe it's 50, yes. I'm hoping not to be 51, but it's okay because I'm really not much of an expert, more of a reporter.
I've sure heard a lot of disclaimers in this first hour or so. Not even been an hour yet. A lot of disclaimers. Are you concerned, Doctor, about what you say tonight and how your colleagues might react to it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, Art. It's a scary world, and it shouldn't be a scary world. The world should be getting to be a better place, a more peaceful and a more open and honest place, a place, you know, we live in a world of abundance. There are miracles happening every day, but in the last 10 years or 8 years or whatever, things have been taking a very strange turn.
Ominous.
That's the word, ominous. And if you read, if you go beyond the media, which, as you and I both know, is highly, highly, highly controlled, and you read the news sources on the internet, the overseas news sources, the alternative news sources, if you read the journals, if you speak with people in the field, you know, people are afraid out there, and they're afraid for good reason because There's strange things afoot, and again, I don't have that keen inside track, but I'd really, you know, I'd sleep better at night if I knew what was really going on, because things just don't add up.
I mentioned Chicago earlier, because I know that's where you are, isn't it?
Well, thanks, Art. Send everyone to my home, why don't you?
You're in Chicago. You're in Chicago, right?
Yes.
So I made Chicago the target. Now, here's a whopper of a question for you. If you woke up tomorrow morning,
yes,
and picked up the Sun Times,
okay,
and the headline was, "Oh my God, Marburg in Chicago,"
yes,
what would you do?
I'd bolt the doors pretty quick. I would get out a filter mask. I'd put on a pair of glasses because, you know, droplets can get to you right through your, you know, through the mucous membranes in your eyes. And I would probably get out of Chicago.
get in a car and go.
Well, I would certainly, I would strongly consider, I would either consider hunkering down and staying where I was and not coming in contact with too many people.
If there was a deliberate spread of Marburg in Chicago, or for that matter, any major U.S. city, you know, with a very dense central population, as our cities have, and it was intentionally spread in places like subways, and I don't know, you can just imagine how horrible it really could be. I for example, here's a question. How long, you might not know the answer to this, how long might Marburg virus last on a surface, typically?
I have no idea what the latency of it, what its capacity is for maintaining viability on a non-living surface.
If all right, then let me try this little scenario on you. Since we apparently this Marburg can be caught through aerosolized a device. If a little airplane flew over Chicago and sprayed Marburg, what are the likely results?
Catastrophic. If this material can be spread by droplet, and I believe the chances are good that it can. If it was to be spread efficiently.
Yes.
Through aerosolization, from a crop dusting plane or some kind of spraying device.
Exactly.
You could potentially infect hundreds of thousands of people in the space of a day.
Mm-hmm. If you were going to test a newer, deadlier version of Marburg with a very, very high
mortality. Now, the good news is, there's a caveat to that.
Oh.
The good news is that many of these biologicals are inactivated by sunlight. So if it was sprayed during the day, and it was any reasonable exposure to high intensity sunlight, that would tend to deactivate the virus.
Well, then they wouldn't spray it during the day.
Well, okay. Well, let's hope they don't spray it ever.
Well, I do hope that, but. I think there's reason to be concerned. My question was that if you wanted to test a new, even deadlier form of Marburg, which this certainly is, with the ability to spread through the air, as we now are learning this can, wouldn't you go right back to Africa, where, horrible as it would be, the world would say, oh yeah, another outbreak in Africa. What else is new?
Well, that is a very sad fact, is that the world doesn't really, the world expects horrors to occur in Africa because they're happening all the time, whether they be civil wars or disease outbreaks or famine or, God only knows what other miseries. And Africa is probably a test bed, certainly a test bed for infectious disease. So could this be another example of it? Well, good question, Art.
How hard would it be for a terrorist to go to this part of Africa and perhaps come up with a blood sample?
Probably not that difficult.
How hard would it be, once you had that blood sample, to culture additional quantities or big quantities of Marburg?
If you had a biological laboratory?
Yes.
And, it wouldn't have to be a terribly sophisticated biological laboratory.
Was
going to
be my next question. How sophisticated would it have to be?
Well, not, as the World Health Organization said, they sent out their samples to 4,000 laboratories around the world. So there's at least 4,000 laboratories that are capable of handling biological tissue and probably amplifying biological tissues. And that's WHO approved laboratories. So if you assume that this would not be an approved laboratory, there's probably quite a few more. It would not have to be that sophisticated.
It
would be certainly within the reach of anyone who had access to standard microbiological technologies, hospitals technologies. You would not need. This is not Star Wars stuff.
Doctor, once you've contracted Marburg, is there anything that you as a doctor can do to save that person's life? Anything at all?
Well, right now, there's certainly nothing posted by the World Health Organization or the CDC with regard to treatment protocols. So right now, there is nothing besides supportive care, and that's not so great. I mean, again, 90% probability of death is not, you know, a good scenario. Now they're talking about, you know, the potential of using some newer antiviral agents, and they're talking about the potential of, you know, of using heparin to inhibit the virus eating up all the clotting factors. This is all experimental right now. Nobody knows how to treat this illness.
God, and you would think, I'm sure they're working as hard on that as they can right now. I mean, they obviously know what we know. That'd be enough. You'd have to be working hard.
Well, it's really difficult to say how much resources has been thrown at this problem.
And you also have to wonder if as many resources have been thrown at the problem as have been thrown at perhaps engineering a bigger problem.
Well, we know that that's not the case. I mean, the budget for biological warfare research is what? It's in the billions. Who knows? But I think that the online reports were saying that the World Health Organization was seeking $3.5 million to help control the outbreak of this illness.
So I wonder
it's
if
like billions for war and pennies
yes.
for peace.
Yes, I wonder if we've recognized the threat of a potential terrorist getting hold of a sample of this to the degree that if something like this breaks out this deadly, that we've got the whole area surrounded with troops and not allowing that kind of person in, right?
Well, I don't think there is any containment going on right now. I haven't read about any plans for containment or for screening people coming back from Africa or I don't think that to be fair though, I mean this is not to incite panic, this is a problem that's in its very early stages. This is not a pandemic. This is not a disease that has spread beyond the local environs of of a couple of countries in Africa. Not that it can't, not that it couldn't spread, very quickly, but so far there's no indication of that. And again, because it kills so quickly, and this is not good news, but the not so bad news is that these types of viruses, these type of infections tend not to become pandemics. They tend to burn themselves out very quickly. That's why
usually,
you haven't seen large groups of people dying from Ebola. Or from other rapidly.
Yeah, but see, this virus, doctor, is not working right. In other
Correct.
Words, it's not working right. Normally, a virus, if I understand the way nature works, if it's too deadly, as you point out, then it's like a little brush fire and it burns itself out because, people get to die very quickly, too quickly. They don't get a chance to spread. So the virus usually adapts by becoming perhaps a little less deadly. So that it can be spread more efficiently. But in this case, we've got two things that I don't understand. One, this is obviously far more deadly than anything we've seen before with Marburg by a gigantic percentage. So it's going in the wrong direction. And number two, it would seem to have not only become more deadly, but also now be possibly spread, through, as you pointed out, the air, which is such a horrible thing to even contemplate. So, it's very suspicious.
Oh, it's entirely suspicious. Well, all the bad news when I was in medical school, AIDS was the big news because you heard of a new disease maybe once every decade. West Nile virus was first identified in 1937, dengue in 1950, Marburg in 1967. You know, these diseases didn't come up, you know, like today. Today it's almost a disease of the month club.
And we're told so little. I mean, for example, doctor, this case of all these specimens, thousands of them going out to labs by, quote, mistake, end quote. You know, by now I would expect to see newspaper headlines. There's been an investigation. They've talked to the lab technicians. They've talked to the doctors, and the World Health Organization should be all over it. But where's the news about how the hell this happened?
That's a good question, Art.
Yeah.
And it makes you wonder why it even came out in the news at all.
Well,
because the news is so heavily controlled, why did this thing even come out in the news? Why is it being played the way it is? And the news sources say that when they tried to talk to the people at the lab that released this material, they were on vacation, unavailable for comment. Well, where can you go on vacation? It doesn't have a telephone.
No, wait a minute. Let me get this straight. The investigators are getting the response that all the people who had to do with releasing this are vacation.
The people who are responsible for the laboratory that produced this material and sent it out.
They're all on vacation.
That the heads of the laboratory are on vacation and were unavailable to comment.
Well, my goodness.
Isn't that interesting? It just gets curiouser and curiouser and curiouser. And like so many things that are out there today, it just makes you scratch your head and wonder. And, you know, I don't know about you, Art, but I kind of feel like it's the best of all worlds and, you know, the best of times and the worst of times, if I can paraphrase, you know, if I can.
You may.
You know, paraphrase, that. You know, we live in a time, and again, I'm a futurist. I'm involved in biotechnology. I'm involved looking to the future of technology, and it's bright. I mean, we're on the cusp of cures for cancer, Alzheimer's disease, heart disease, diabetes. Stem cell technology is taking off. And
oh, you're right. We're going to talk about all that. Hold on, doctor. We are at the top of the hour from the high desert in the middle of the night with some rough-to-take news. I'm Art Bell.
Code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from East of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From West of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is. And, of course, Dr. Ronald Klatz, who is my guest. We're talking about Marburg. We're going to talk about other things, but this current outbreak in Africa certainly is disturbingly suspicious. Would that be a good way to put it? This music is ideal for this sort of thing. You remember the beginning of that movie? Captain Tripsville. And the music starts. The guy drops the vial, and pretty soon the guard at the gate is running. And that's about it. That is to say, the beginning, the end of the world. We'll be right back. So in Africa, we have this thing called Marburg, with near a 100% fatality rate. Not quite, but near 100. I mean, just radically, incredibly up from where it was. And with the new apparent added feature of being aerosolized, in other words, droplets in the air, as in a sneeze or a cough, causing another person to get it. These are radical changes, and they're being under-publicized, perhaps for understandable reasons. But, you know, here's what I worry about. Let's develop it this way. Doctor, you were referring to the flu, and you said it was a bio-level, what'd you say, 3?
Yeah, bio-level 2.
2, where, all right, bio-level 2.
And it maybe it should have been a bio-level 3, but it's at least a bio-level 2.
At least a 2, all right. With a bio-level 2 virus, if you had a vial of it, what does that mean you take in terms of security precautions?
Well, you certainly don't want to let it, you know, roam around freely. You may not have to keep it in a lab that is a high containment laboratory, but it's a pathogen. It's a known pathogen of which there is no cure. So, you know, you're going to take some safety precautions with that, certainly.
All right.
And it's not like you wouldn't know, where the people who are handling it wouldn't know what they were dealing with.
Uh-huh.
But I think more interestingly is that these samples were sent out mislabeled.
Yes. Now, to continue, Marburg, particularly the strain now breaking out in Africa, that would be a level what?
That would be a level 4.
A level
same
4.
Same as Ebola.
So that means guys in spacesuits virtually?
Exactly.
Sealed rooms, air, over air pressure, all that kind of stuff, right?
Exactly.
All right, so bio-level 4 danger. We're now, in America, with bio-level 4 agents, we do have the spacesuits. We have labs. We have locked, sealed, over-pressurized rooms, and that's kind of precaution people take. But somehow, see, what worries me is that's one picture in labs where it can be safely handled, I guess. But now think about an African village or villages, perhaps even in a region. I'm thinking maybe as a terrorist would think. They might have a hard time getting into that level 4 lab and stealing. But they might not have as hard a time getting to that area of Africa being stricken right now. Right?
No, I would not imagine it would be difficult at all.
All right. I just sort of thought of a term during the news. Think of the term vectoring martyrs.
All right.
Vectoring martyrs. Now, that would only be a concerning thing, of course, if you had people willing to die for their cause. Right.
Certainly, some of these people are willing to die for their cause. Yes.
Yeah, vectoring martyrs. That's a terrible phrase and a terrible thought. So, you know, with those things in mind, and I don't see how you cannot have them in mind. Shouldn't there be United Nations forces surrounding this area, preventing people from getting in?
Well, I don't know that you really can prevent people, because they don't know where the virus is. It would be nice if the virus was confined to a nice, clean, small area, but it's already around in several countries. It's in Angola and in several surrounding countries as well.
Mm.
So it's not that nice and neat a deal, and that's really the problem.
Well, if people who can write novels think about these things and talk hosts can think about these things, I imagine these inventive terrorists have thought of it long ago. So we may face something like this in the very near future.
Yes, we might. And or it may, you know, it's
Let me open up.
It's very troubling, Art. It's all very troubling because
yes.
it's you know, here I'm reading a report from China View Newswire, and they're talking about six additional cases found in Kwanzaa, Seoul, Zaire, Luanda, Menage, Kwanzaa, and Cambinda.
Are you talking about Marburg?
I'm talking about Marburg. So it's it's already out of a discrete small area, so very hard to contain.
Yes, and that's the first thing the CDC always does, right? They try to get it in a specific area and quickly,
yes,
strictly, I would hope, contain it. But you're saying it's already out of that range, huh?
Apparently so. And
wow.
You know, I don't want people to stay up and, you know, have nightmares about Marburg coming to the United States anytime soon. I don't think that there's good reason to expect that. Not yet, anyway. But, you know, you're absolutely right. This is a very troublesome issue. And, SARS is 75% fatal. Bird flu is 50% fatal. And the head of the World Health Organization is talking about if a bird flu pandemic was to strike, and the bird flu was to that they're fighting right now in Vietnam and in parts of Asia was to find its way around the globe, it could lead to perhaps a billion deaths
if it were to become airborne.
Yes.
And God, here's another thing, Doctor. That I don't get. I've read story after story after story after story where scientists are virtually, and doctors are predicting that it's going to become airborne. I mean, it's almost like they're anticipating it's going to become airborne and telling us it's going to happen. It's unnerving.
Indeed it is, Art.
Why would they have such strong suspicions that we get story after story after story like that?
Well, maybe somebody knows something more than I do.
Oh, God. It's so easy to read between your careful lines regarding what you believe and what you think. I mean, you're obviously very suspicious about what's going on, aren't you?
Well, we live in dangerous times, Art, and it doesn't make me feel comfortable, and I just wonder if it really needs to be that way. And certainly, there's no clear answers out there. And, you know, so all you're left with is speculation. But, signs point towards not as rosy and as promising a future as we could expect, as I thought the world would be just, 5 years ago.
Would you travel to Africa now?
Not right now, no.
No.
Well, I'll tell you why I wouldn't travel to Africa. I wouldn't travel to Africa not because of Marburg. I don't think I'd be concerned about Marburg right now. As a matter of fact, that would not stop me from traveling to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
What concerns me is I have some colleagues who are in Africa doing other types of biological research, separate and apart from infectious disease. They're doing work actually in stem cell technology. But the areas of Africa that they're at have epidemic amounts of Anopheles mosquitoes that carry malaria. And one mosquito bite is all it takes. And you have almost 100% risk of developing malaria unless you are taking anti-malarial drugs, which in and of themselves are not safe.
Well, I was in Africa. I went to the Kruger Animal Preserve in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And if I remember anything well and distinctly, Doctor, it was that they had gigantic mosquitoes and that even the best little huts designed for Westerners didn't keep them out, and you had to sleep in a bed with a mosquito netting around it, and you still got the hell bit out of you when you were out.
Well, in this particular area of Africa, I won't mention where, my friends tell me that that the penetration of malaria is almost 100%. And
holy
so if
source.
They're not on anti-malarial medication, they will certainly succumb to malaria. And this particular area of Africa has a 20% fatality rate among newborns.
Well, even the supposedly relatively safe part of Africa I was in required that I take anti-malarial medicine before I got there and while I was there and for, I think, 5 days after I left.
That's right. There's over 10 million deaths a year, and I think that's a low number. It may be 20 million deaths a year due to mosquito-borne illnesses, mostly malaria. I mean, that's a huge number. I mean, think of that. That makes the mosquito the most deadly animal on planet Earth.
All right. Let's turn our attention a little bit. You mentioned
Oh, Art, before we go off this topic.
Yes.
I have something for your listeners.
Proceed.
Plus, I've been getting email, by the way, from some people who are listening to the show. On our website, you're familiar with it, worldhealth.net?
Now everybody is. Worldhealth.net. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Worldhealth.net. On our website, you can sign up for our biotech newsletter. It's on the top left-hand corner on the home page. And if anyone signs up for the biotech newsletter, this week I'm going to put out a special report on how to protect against viral infection, how to improve your immunity with what natural substances we have that are out there. As you may recall, I wrote the book Infection Protection a few years ago.
Yes.
Which dealt with, you know, specifically, you know, how to common sense methods of protecting yourself from infectious diseases. Now, not particularly Ebola and Marburg virus,
right.
Of course, but
right.
Influenza and certainly other things like that. There are a lot of practical ways and nutritional ways to build your immunity and protect yourself from typical infections that are out there, and I'm going to give that out free to any of your listeners who logs onto worldhealth.net and signs up for our biotech newsletter.
There'll be plenty of those. Stem cells, how exciting should the audience regard stem cell research? How exciting is it?
It's breakthrough. It's a technology that's not just great promise. It's a technology that's already proven itself. They're using stem cells right now in dogs, and veterinarians are using it in dogs to cure cancer, in horses to heal joints, damaged joints and broken limbs.
Can I back up? Cancer is, you know, the big C, right? You said they're using stem cells to cure cancer in dogs. What kind of cancer and with what success rate?
Well, it's only experimental, so I can't tell you what the success rate is because there's only been a few cases. But in the few cases that have been reported, it's been 100% successful for leukemia.
That's a wow.
Exactly.
That's a big wow.
Yeah. You see, stem cells can rebuild the immune system of the body. Stem cells are, as a matter of fact, we've been doing stem cell therapy for many years.
Are you referring, just for the record, to fetal stem cells in this case, or are you referring to mature stem cells?
Really, when I talk about stem cells, I'm talking about the whole spectrum. But the argument between fetal stem cells and non-fetal stem cells, I believe, is a non-issue, because almost everything that you can do with fetal stem cells, you can do with adult stem cells if you modify the cells properly, or you can certainly do with placental stem cells, which are just as good as fetal stem cells for almost all applications. So you don't have to ever touch a fetus. You don't ever have to destroy a human being.
Well, if I had a fatal leukemia, could I go and get that treatment as a last resort?
If you could find a research center that was doing it, you certainly could. We've been doing stem cell therapy for the last 30 years. It was called bone marrow transplants. Because guess what the bone marrow is? It's all stem cells.
Well, right.
Okay.
That's a good point.
And now we're refining the technology to make it more targeted. Stem cells have been successful in reversing brain damage and stroke, are being used experimentally in Alzheimer's disease. The results aren't quite in yet, but it looks promising. There are reports of people who have been paralyzed with spinal cord injuries, very severe transections or crush injuries of the spinal cord,
right,
who have gotten some, or in a couple of reported cases, most of their sensation and some of their function back in their limbs.
A question, doctor. Are these stem cells just raw stem cells, unchanged stem cells that are, what, injected or into a human or a dog, whatever, or what? What are we talking about here?
Well, there's many different ways of preparing stem cells. It's not just one way. So if you're treating neurological injuries, you want nerve stem cells. If you're treating bone injuries, you want bone stem cells. If you're treating, if you're trying to repair the heart, you want muscle stem cells.
Okay.
So you're looking for, and then there's just like the general, you know, shotgun approach that's being attempted right now, where people are taking placental tissue, the afterbirth.
Yes.
And are extracting the stem cells from the placenta tissue. The placenta is a massive amount of stem cells,
right,
in the placenta that we just throw away after the birth.
Right.
And people are taking those stem cells now and dropping them into individuals through an IV for a shotgun approach for rejuvenation.
And what are the early reports?
The early reports are for some conditions, chronic fatigue, problems with immune incompetence, that this appears to have some beneficial effect. Now, for things such as repairing the heart, you have to get right down to the heart tissue and insert a catheter into the damaged tissue and inject the stem cells right into that damaged tissue.
Where would, for example, where would one harvest, let's say, heart-friendly stem cells?
Well, you can get it from placenta. You can differentiate the cells in the laboratory.
Okay, that's what I was after.
Yeah.
Differentiating. In other words, you actually can pull out, and I can only wonder how that's done. How do you differentiate these cells?
Well, the stem cells that you will recover from the placenta are at very early stage stem cells. They're almost embryonic.
Right.
And so they have gone... there's several stages of development that stem cells go through, from embryonic to final tissue.
Embryonic is kind of like a blank slate stem cell. It has not yet become a heart or a liver or a brain stem cell, right?
Exactly.
So those are valuable because they can sort of treat blank shotgun style any problem.
Almost any problem, yes. Whereas the adult stem cells are much further differentiated. So if you had adult stem cells for brain tissue, you could use it for brain, but only for brain. You wouldn't be able to use it for...
And a treatment of stem cells for the brain would do what, doctor? You'd actually grow more tissue?
You'd grow new nerve tissue.
You would?
Yes, you would. You'd actually be able to bridge nerve damage in the case of stroke or in the case of severed nerves.
Wow.
And this is what's going on right now. There's a neurosurgeon in China, in Beijing, who has reported, and this has been reported on BBC and in other news services, that he has had people who've had transected spinal cords, who these people have some degree of motion and quite a bit of sensation now because of this. He also reports he's treated stroke successfully, and he's treated other neurological disorders. He's now doing a series of people with ALS.
But in China. All right, doctor, hold tight. We're here at the bottom of the hour. The fact of the matter is, there's a very great deal more of this kind of experimentation going on in China. Because here, of course, we have laws against some of it. So China is racing right ahead. They don't have those laws.
Riders of the storm. Riders of the storm. Into this house we're born, into this world we're thrown. Like a
with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Welcome back to what I cynically dubbed the Hour of Hope show on Coast to Coast AM. You know, I've always been a fan of end-of-the-world novels, which, well, in the 50s and 60s, concentrated on the possibility of nuclear holocaust. But now, there's an endless supply of things that could rather neatly, or not so neatly, end our world. And all these things are little, and we're talking about them. Viruses, like Marburg, now loose in Africa, like, oh, I don't know, perhaps something from the world of nanotechnology or stem cell research or somebody's newest idea of what to clone. So many little things. Once again, Dr. Klantz. Doctor, welcome back. Most of these technologies, certainly Marburg and viruses and nanotechnology, oh boy, a lot of possible downsides to the world of nanotechnology. But, you know, this business with stem cells, I'm almost afraid to ask, but it nearly seems like stem cells might be an area of research that holds nothing but good possibilities, or is there a possible downside and something to be concerned about with stem cell research?
Well, Art, you can always, you know, you can pervert the most beautiful, lovely thing in the world if you try hard enough.
Oh.
And I'm sure that someone will. But right now, stem cells look pretty darn good. I mean, the science is strong. The technology is strong morally, ethically. There's really no legitimate argument against it.
Anymore?
Well, there really wasn't to begin with.
Well, that is an opinion. I mean, in the opinion of many, of course, there was a problem with it because it was fetal. Anyway.
My point is, even from the beginning, we never had to look any further than placentas to get all the stem cells we've ever needed.
Well, then I'm afraid to ask, all right, try and imagine for me, where would there be an intentional downside? In other words, if somebody wanted to do the worst with stem cells, I didn't know there was a downside, so what would it be?
Yeah, that's my point, is I really don't know. I mean,
oh, good.
You want to know what the downside is? Stem cell technology is one of those technologies that could lead to potential, to practical human immortality.
That's sure a big upside, but I'm just saying it wouldn't. You don't envision any way that stem cell research could be used to concoct a new weapon.
Well,
do you?
Not offhand, no. You know, it's not even a discussion point. You know, around coffee after these conferences are over, no one's looking at that.
Good.
So I don't see stem cells being having a dual use problem associated with them.
So, but on the other hand, immortality could be around the corner.
It could be around the corner if those in power would let it out of the box. You know?
Before they let other stuff out of the box.
Exactly. Before.
It's kind of a race, right?
It's looking that way, isn't it?
Yes.
It's really looking that way. I mean, we're on the cusp of so many fantastic new technologies. Robotics is coming on strong. Nanotechnology has tremendous potential. Alternative energy sources are real now.
Oh, listen, I'm so on to nanotechnology. I've actually talked to people now, doctor, who confirm that there's already a paint. You can paint your house with this paint. and supply the power to your house.
Yeah, because the paint on solar cell. You can paint the whole building.
Paint on solar cell. There's clothing already available, nanotechnology clothing that adjusts to all sorts of things. It's amazing where it's going. But the world of nano, I just read Prey. I don't know if that's a book you've read yet. If you haven't, you should.
Not yet, no.
It's about a designer little piece of nanotechnology that started out to be a defense project. In other words, defense needed a camera. You know, a camera. They needed to be able to get a camera that could be airborne and couldn't be shot down. So what they came up with was a swarm of these little nanobots, each one of them being part of a camera, taking a picture. And this swarm, of course, you can't shoot a swarm.
No.
You might get some of them, but you're not going to get them all, not a swarm of little teeny thick cameras. And something, of course, inevitably went wrong. It's a novel. Things always go wrong. And these little things had power supplies. So during the day, they took energy from the sun. They began to learn themselves, evolve, if you will. And they were designed software-wise with a sort of predator-prey mentality. And that's exactly, of course, what happened. It was a frightening but wonderful book called Prey. Crichton wrote it, and that's sort of the downside of nanotechnology as it merges into the biological world.
Well, that's the real problem with biologicals and why they're so horrible. You know, why these are such horrible weapons, because they do have a life of their own, and they do tend to mutate, and they can go in different directions than you intend them to. And as nanotechnology becomes more and more lifelike, and robotics becomes more and more lifelike, I mean, after all, we now have, you know, we started with robotic drones, airplanes, and as soon as we got airplanes that were autonomous, what's the first thing we did? We put missiles on them.
Of course.
You know, now South Korea is talking about having autonomous robots to guard their DMZ.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I hadn't heard that one.
Oh, this is kind of, like I said, this is frightening stuff. So we live in a very strange duality right now, and it is a race. It is a race to the finish line, because with the singularity occurring in 2029, or maybe before, with this explosion of technological knowledge that we have in front of us, we have the power to do great good or great evil in the world, and
either to become immortal or to erase the possibility of ever becoming immortal, much less living what we consider now to be a normal lifespan.
Very true, Art. Very true. You've pretty much hit on the kernel of my angst.
Yes, your angst.
It's certainly no fun to, you know, it's no fun to be the last man to die.
Yeah.
Of aging-related disease.
It
now
sounds
is
like
it.
This has hit you fairly recently, Doctor. Hasn't
well,
it?
The world has changed in a very profound way in the last 5, 6, 7 years.
Yes.
I mean, everything was go, go, go. You know, everything was looking good. The world was a very bright place 7 years ago, and for some reason, for some very strange reason, the world is not quite as I'm not quite as optimistic today, mostly because of world events.
It really is strange. I mean, think of it. We went from the celebration of the end of the Cold War, the Berlin Wall comes tumbling down.
That's right. Now we don't have to worry about atomic warfare.
Right.
We can live as one unified planet. You know.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that celebration sure didn't last very long, did it?
No. And why is that, Art? And why aren't they telling us why?
I'm not exactly sure. It has something to do with the very nature of man himself, I guess. I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. I was hoping you might.
Sorry, Art.
So it's been a little bit depressing. I mean, the headlines and where everything is going is a little depressing, and it is a race. Who do you think's winning? I guess the cause of your depression indicates you're beginning to be suspicious that...
Before the world went crazy, I thought that things were jumbled up because of greed or stupidity or confusion or private interests. But when you look at world events, you have to say, is there a hand behind some of this?
In other words, before you thought it was at least nasty but benign, and now you see a hand behind it, perhaps.
Well, I wonder why we can't get a straight story from the media, why we can't get genuine investigative reporting.
I wonder about that, too.
Okay, I wonder why, why things that seem so straightforward are not so straightforward. For example, on infectious disease, I was reading on a news service that AIDS could be prevented by and large if we had a virucidal a lubricant for to prevent irritation and the transmission of with the active intercourse.
Really?
Yeah, and I talk about this, by the way, in my book Infection Protection. And again, the information that I'm going to give away free to your listeners is available at www.worldhealth.net. And they just have to sign up for the biotech newsletter, and they'll get the free information on protecting themselves from infectious disease and immunity. But in my book, Infection Protection, I talk about that. I say, why couldn't we come up with a product called Love Lube? I even gave it a name. And it would be a lubricant that was impregnated with antiviral agents that would at least protect from...
Doctor, what additional percentage of protection would be afforded by that? Do you know?
Well, some of the researchers are talking about perhaps 80%.
Mm-hmm.
80% protection, possibly. Now, the literature, the news services are talking about that this product is under development and it might be available in another 5 years. Well, what the heck are they waiting 5 years for? Why should such a product, which is topical, which is not an internally taken drug, require 5 years of research and development when ostensibly millions of people are infected and, thousands are dying every year, or tens of thousands are dying every year?
Well, I thought that kind of urgent emergency need would cause such product to transcend the usual years of required testing.
One would think so, Art, and that's just one example of things that just don't make sense. Just like these this viral test kit, mistakenly being sent out to 4,000 labs with the wrong virus, with a pathogenic virus inside of it, and it being mislabeled.
Well, again,
there's so many things out there that don't make sense.
Well, what doesn't make sense to me, Doctor, is that we're not... This is such a gigantic... It's such a mountain of a story that it's not sufficient for you to tell me the investigators are finding the people responsible for this are on vacation. That doesn't work.
But that is the state of the reporting that we are given here in this country today.
Well, that's horrible.
Indeed it is. And so it you have to scratch your head and say, is this just that we have incompetent reporters, that we have an incompetent news service? Or is there something else going on?
What else do you imagine is going on?
Lord, I can't say. I don't want to be number 51.
God, are you really that worried? I mean, are you that worried that...
No, I guess I'm not that worried, but I don't want to... I'm still a physician and a scientist, and I have to talk from... even though I'm happy to speculate with you, I still have to stand on things that I can substantiate. And so it's anything else would be wild speculation on my part. My point is that I'm afraid. My point is that I'm concerned that I don't have answers, and I'm used to having answers. I'm an answer guy. And the people that I know and respect who are answer guys don't have the answers either. Things don't make sense, Art. They don't fit. And they should fit. And why don't they? And if they don't, is there a reason for that?
Yeah, I'm as puzzled as you are. Things are happening that are not explained, and
they're black things. That's the point.
Yes.
These are black things that are happening.
Very black.
And there are solutions, but the solutions are not being applied.
Well, you know, on the one hand, it's got to be a good thing that this this influenza, for example, that was shipped, is big news. You know, the mistake is big news. What is puzzling me is that we have no answers to how this massive a mistake could have been made, how we even had that much influenza produced to be able to send out to thousands of labs, where the people are, what the explanation is, none of that. I mean, we don't have any of that. And so, yeah, is it a lazy press? Is it a big secret? Has the government clamped down on all of this? Are we that dumb? There's a lot of silence there on the other end of the phone. you don't have the answers either.
No, I don't, Arne. Anybody with a discerning mind should be asking the same questions you are, and I am. And the problem is, I think the biggest problem is, there's nowhere to go for these answers. You ask them, but they don't get answered.
Yeah, I just have the internet, which is going to give you a little more information, frankly. In fact, maybe sometimes too much information, so much you can't discern what's true and what's BS. So at least it's a source outside the regular American 5-minute newscast or 30-minute newscast, whatever you can fit in 22 minutes or whatever it is, minus commercials. So there's a little bit overload of some information out there, but how does one pick through the wheat and the chaff and get to the kinds of answers to these questions that we need? I don't know, and I guess you don't either, and that really scares me because that's your biz.
Well, maybe one of your listeners knows, Art.
All right. Well, we're going to get to that part and take calls here pretty quickly. Artificial organs, stem cells. Will stem cells, doctor, soon turn into the ability to grow artificial organs, kidneys, for example?
That is a very good question.
In a vat somewhere, you know, just a growing kidney.
Well, the trick to growing an organ is having the right scaffolding, being able to grow it in three dimensions, not just on a flat plate of tissues.
Right
now we can grow a flat sheet of organ tissue very easily.
Okay.
And there are those who are working in stem cells who believe that we will be able to, just as we already have, we've reseeded the heart. We've injected stem cells directly into the heart, reseeded it, and grown new heart tissue, functioning heart tissue. Brain tissue, that seems to be working as well. There are those who believe that we may be able to take a damaged kidney or diseased kidney and inject stem cells directly into the kidney and repair that organ. Stem cells certainly can be injected into the body and create a new immune system.
Doctor, is China far ahead of us in testing this kind of thing on human beings?
Oh, far, far ahead of us on clinical studies.
Really?
Yeah, because it's so difficult. We have a health system, in my opinion, that is broken. That is broken and may be broken beyond repair. It is so incredibly expensive, incredibly difficult, and incredibly time consuming, to conduct clinical research, even in cases where people are doomed. And, you know, the example that I was talking about with the lubricant for
right.
HIV.
Right, exactly right.
Why the heck is that not out on the market already?
Well, we have a lot of really good questions, don't we, Doctor? And in a moment, let's let the audience ask some really good questions themselves. My guest is Dr. Ronald Klatz. By now, you should have written down the appropriate number for your area. If not, there'll be one more chance after the break, and Dr. Ronald Klatz will take calls. It's been quite a night, and the next hour promises to be quite quite an hour. It'll be all yours. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell.
And then to burst up through tarmac to the sun again, or to fly to the sun without burning a wing, to lie in a meadow and hear the grass sing, to have all these things in our memory stored, and to use them to help us to
talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is, and we kind of specialize in having people at the top of their game on this program. Dr. Ronald Clouds is clearly in that category. So we're going to go to the phones. If you have a question for Dr. Clouds about any of these new biological areas of research, these wild things, nanotechnology, cloning. Oh, we have to touch on cloning. The Marburg virus, the dangerous things that are going on right now, the general state of the world, which is, I guess, what we've been talking about a little bit. We're about to dive into the phones. That means your turn. Tomorrow night, we're going to talk more about, well, you remember at the beginning of the program, I talked to you about the Princeton eggs, the fact they're going berserk right now, something you ought to pay close attention to, incidentally. Very close attention. Tomorrow night, we're going to sort of delve into that field a little more. Prayer, human consciousness, that sort of thing. It's absolutely fascinating, the work going on at Princeton. And it'll be in that area that we travel tomorrow night on this program. In the meantime, Dr. Clouds and all of you coming up directly. You know, I have a computer next to me, handily displaying the message that are sent, messages sent in by all of you with a service called Fast Blast on the website. You can type a question in and send it to me, and I get, well, thousands during the program. But to give you some idea of what, there's a lot of good people in the world. And this is really going to the core of what Dr. Clouds and myself have been talking about for a couple of hours right now. There are a lot of good people in the world, but there is another element out there. Now, I've got this cute little picture of a kitten that fell asleep on top of a ball of yarn on my webcam. And so somebody calling himself Craig from Flagstaff, Arizona, writes to me, "Hey, Jew boy. Someone needs to slip and light an M80 under that cat's head on the webcam." Now, the conspiracy fruitcakes out there have thought that I, they're just certain that I'm Jewish. there's web pages devoted to it out there. I'm not, by the way, I'm Lutheran. But, you know, that fits in their category of vicious hate thinking, you know, and that's the kind of vicious hate thinking that's going on out there. Hey, Jew boy, someone needs to slip and light an M80 under that cassette on the webcam. Thanks, Greg. Yeah, that's cool. See, those are the kind of people, Dr. Klatz, that we're in a race with, you know?
Well, I wish it was that simple, Art. Those people don't bother me so much. I mean, I shouldn't say they don't bother me. They don't scare me as much as the people who I think we are in a race with, and that's people who have a completely separate agenda for which way the world is going.
Yeah, doctor, but these people hate.
Oh, I know. I'm just telling you. I don't like them. I don't condone them any more than you do.
I'm just telling you that there's an atmosphere of hatred out there that's so deep and so, dare I use the word, evil.
Yeah, and it's unnecessary. That's the whole thing.
I know.
That's the whole thing. The world doesn't need to be... there's no need for hate anymore. There's plenty enough to go around for everyone. We live in amazing abundance.
But this is the most... perplexing aspect of the whole thing. As we race toward these wonderful possibilities that you describe so enthusiastically, we're also in the race with these idiots who want everything destroyed. They really do. I'm believing they want everything destroyed. Anyway, it was just an example of the kind of evil-minded, horrid hate stuff out there. Anyway, listen, one more thing
Before we end tonight, we really should talk about the codex and the risk to personal health freedoms, because...
What is the codex?
That's very important.
What is the codex?
The codex alimentarium is the European code for food safety. And it's kind of like the code for the equivalent of the European FDA.
Okay.
And the codex is important because it establishes what are safe levels of various foods or nutrients. And the codex that is being pushed forward in the European Parliament, the new codex, is essentially trying to relabel all foods that have a therapeutic effect as drugs. Now,
what?
Yes.
Meaning they would be, meaning you'd have to go to the doctor to get a prescription for apples?
Well, if you wanted the active ingredient in apples, yes, indeed. If you wanted to buy high-potency vitamin C, you would need a prescription for it. You do now, by the way, in several European countries because of the existing codex rules. And this is being pushed forward by the pharmaceutical industry.
Brother.
And by the total control power people who want to essentially control everyone's health destiny.
Mm.
And it flies in the face of Deche, which has given us tremendous freedoms with regard to nutritional and personal health issues in the United States. And the FDA has come along and stated publicly that they intend to harmonize their rules in accordance with Codex. So if Codex passes for all of Europe, it would essentially ban any high-dose nutrient. 5,000 nutrients that are available in health food stores all over the United States would be considered illegal in Europe if Codex passes.
Doctor, we already hear of SWAT teams batting down the doors of health food stores around the country. You see these weird stories of this stuff going on, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The doors are getting bashed in for what?
Good question. Well, the latest, you know, there's all these little scares. You know, ephedra was dangerous, even though ephedra was used in medicine and by the public for the last 2,000 years, suddenly ephedra was this demonized drug that had to be banned by the FDA.
Yeah, I saw that.
And interestingly, in Florida, just this last week, a judge overruled the FDA's opinion and is now made calling their opinions overbroad. But there is a concerted effort on the parts of some individuals who want to control all of your healthcare destiny to deny you freedom of choice in nutrients or even in foods. And your listeners need to pay attention to this because it will affect us here in the United States if it passes in Europe. Now, luckily, And we have a slight reprieve because there was a suit brought against this in the European High Court. And quite surprisingly, the Chief Justice of the European High Court said that the Codex rulings were arbitrary and overbroad and overreaching, and he recommended that they not be passed, but that doesn't mean that they won't be passed.
And if they are, then an apple a day is going to require a doctor.
Almost certainly.
Good Lord. All right.
And this information, by the way, about the Codex and Deshaies and the healthcare freedoms is available at, of course, www.worldhealth.net.
Well, I'll bet they're humming right over to that website. I hope you've got the I hope you've got the bandwidth to contend with it, because we've got a lot of notches on our We've Killed a Website log. Anyway, listen, we promised calls, so here they come. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Klatz. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Klatz and Art.
Hi.
Good to talk to you.
And you.
I have one of your books, The Anti-Aging Revolution. It's pretty good.
No, thank you.
I have a comment and a question. My comment is, I think, pretty much the same people that are behind eliminating the biochemists are probably the same people that have the vanishing virus. I think they're going to give us another world disease, and this is just a way of blaming the fault some poor guy in a lab so that maybe they can give us a new outbreak and make money for the pharmaceuticals. That's my opinion. Just like AIDS. I think AIDS was manufactured by man.
Pretty cynical.
Well, you have to talk to the right people that know the inside story. What I wanted to ask you was, last week Art was talking about a lady was on the phone saying how meat can cause Alzheimer's, can cause cancer, and what do you think about eating beef?
Well, there are, of course, some people who believe, Dr. Klatz, that Alzheimer's is really BSD, you know, mad cow.
Well, there is an awful lot to be concerned about with mad cow disease, Pyron disease. And the pyron particles look suspiciously like the neurotangles that can occur, that do occur, and are pathognomonic of the lesions for Alzheimer's disease. And that connection has not been disproven as of yet. And so there are people who are concerned about that, and there are people who are concerned that the United States is not really testing its cattle for pyron disease. In the only beef that I would eat today would be beef from Japan, because 100% of their cattle is tested for pyron disease.
You don't eat beef?
Not anymore, and boy, I love my McDonald's burgers.
Oh man,
I used
me
to
too.
Love those steaks,
oh.
And I've given them up because I can't take the risk.
Ma'am, there you are.
Thank you, Art. And I think the guy that left you that note is just a very unevolved, probably a teenager.
Yeah, but you know. It just indicates, I guess, what mindsets are out there, and some of them are very evil and very hateful. And when these people are in positions of, why do you think these? Do you think, first of all, doctor, that an abnormal number of microbiologists and scientists have been murdered, or is it just somebody keeping, you know,
good records?
Well, I can't figure it out.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, at first I started thinking, well, you know, there's a lot of, you know, scientists out there. This isn't, you know, 50 deaths in the last 3-4 years isn't so unusual. But when you look at how these people died, many of them being murders, suspicious suicides, one guy being chopped up into little pieces and stuffed into three different suitcases, you kind of go, hey, what is happening here? And a suspicious amount of them are involved in microbiology and associated with government-sponsored research.
Well, you must have colleagues who are in the fields of microbiology.
Yes.
Right? Are they, let me ask you this, honestly, have you talked with them privately, and are they privately concerned about these stories?
Most of them are unaware, but the ones who are aware have raised their eyebrows and have said, now, I don't have a tremendous amount of contacts who are involved in in the types of microbiology that would be sensitive. Most of my contacts are in clinical medicine.
Uh-huh.
And so I don't deal in those dark realms where secrecy is a big issue.
Uh-huh.
But even the guys I talk to in clinical medicine raise their eyebrows once I make them aware of this and they see the numbers, because these numbers are, you know, alarming, especially the types of deaths that you see, because these are relatively young people.
You're the
in
first,
their 40s and 50s.
You're the first doctor that I've heard say this in public.
Well, maybe I'm just foolish. I should keep my mouth shut.
No.
You have a way of squeezing it out of me, Art.
Well, you really are the first doctor who's said this out loud. So I appreciate it.
And again, I'm not saying that there absolutely is something to it, but it deserves an explanation. Let's put it that way.
Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Dr. Klatz. Good morning.
Good morning, Art. Hi, Dr. Klatz. I'm also from Chicago. My question to you is, has there been any research done that you know of as far as the Marburg virus having been possibly lab-created?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. I think there are... let me ask this, Doctor. Are there ways of looking at a virus and saying, ho-ho, that's man's hand is obviously involved here, or can it be ruled out?
There are ways to sequence tissues or sequence genetics in an organism and see how closely or not so closely those sequences occur in nature. And if there's a real aberration, does this fit? There are ways of doing that, but again, it's outside of my area of expertise. I'm not involved in those types of forensics.
But wait a minute. You're saying there is a way.
There are ways to get indications, but I don't think there is an absolute 100% way to say, yes, this occurred by the hand of man or this occurred by nature. There are things that make you suspicious if you see sequences that don't occur within nature.
All right, let's take the AIDS virus, for example. There are so many suspicious things about that. It was discussed at a congressional or a Senate hearing. That's well known, that such a virus could be constructed, prior to its emergence, I might add.
Another thing that makes you go,
Well, yeah, So the answer is there are indications that you could come up with, but no absolute smoking gun proof, huh?
Not that I'm aware of, but again, it's beyond my level of sophistication and expertise. I have a passing knowledge of these things, but not a detailed understanding of forensics. You know, the person who would be great to talk to is Dr. Duesenberg.
I have interviewed Dr. Duesenberg. As a matter of fact, and I might reach out and look for him again. Caller, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. And I have one final statement real quickly.
Sure.
I don't know if the doctor is aware that the vast warfare arsenal that the Soviet Union has had in the past is still in Russia, and these are viruses that have been combined together where there is no cure for them. If they are ever used on the United States, we are in deep, deep trouble because there is no cure, and they keep modifying themselves. So I want people to keep in mind that Russia has never disposed of their biological arsenal.
But of course, there's one aspect here. If there's no cure, truly no cure, then you'd have to think many times before you release something that would be suicidal.
That's so true. Very true.
If Russia has
it, then I guess that means we have it too, huh?
I hear that we have been disposing of ours. I don't know how true that is, but that's the latest information that I have.
But then there would be a doomsday virus gap, so...
Well, this is true, but let's hope that it's never used. And one final statement. I have to wonder if we are not our own worst enemy, Doctor, and I would agree with everything you have said. I'm very suspicious.
Well, that makes I think three of us.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you, caller, and take care. One more, perhaps. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Klatz. Hello.
Yes, my name is Stephen, calling from North Miami Beach, Florida.
All right.
And the question I have, based on everything that you've talked about tonight, it's a really good question. The question I should ask first, really, is has anyone asked the FBI if they've looked into this distribution of that virus in the thousands of labs around the world? Because that's a crime.
Good question.
But potentially it is, I suppose, or it could be an accident. Yeah, that's where we're asking that question. Has anybody... We don't know. They're not telling us, sir.
Has there been anything in the news about it?
No, I'm looking all over the place in the news for some answers to this.
The news is very sparse on this topic.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the next question, associated with that, with these people on vacation, and no one's asked the FBI, and no government statement has come out about this. In your opinion, based on everything that's been happening since 9/11, including what you've talked about tonight, does it look to you... including the deaths of 50 microbiologists in the last 4 years, does it look to you like this present administration really cares about what happens to people around the world, even in this country?
All right. Hold that answer, doctor, until after the break. It's a is George Bush doing it question, I guess, right? So we are going to take a break. If you have a question for Dr. Klatz, we are at your disposal at those numbers.
With Art Bell. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
This music is so appropriate, isn't it, for the material we're covering? On the one hand, the world stands at the juncture of a wonderful, wonderful advance in so many areas of medicine that might keep us alive forever. And at that exact moment, as we're at that precipice, we also face the extinction of mankind. It's incredible, both at once. Once again, Dr. Ronald Klatz, and he's absolutely earned the opportunity to plug the heck out of his website. If you want to read more, that's what his website is for. Doctor, hit it again.
Sure. I'd recommend that people sign up for our free biotech newsletter. It's on the homepage right at the top, free newsletter, at www.worldhealth.net. If you sign up for the newsletter, we'll send you in the next newsletter from my book, Infection Protection, a free chapter on how to improve your immunity and how to protect yourself from some of the pathogens that are floating around in our environment.
Your newsletter is free, Doctor?
Yes, it is.
How do you do that?
Well, we're a nonprofit organization, the American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine, where there were 14,500 physicians from 78 countries around the world, and our mission is really to improve the quality and the quantity of the human lifespan. And so it's our mission, and so we provide all this for free.
Okay. If I may ask, Doctor, you certainly in the prior appearances on this program have been an extremely optimistic man, and I know that at heart you still are. How many, although I must say recently you seem very concerned, and I wonder how many of your colleagues privately share your concerns?
Oh, it's way too many.
Really?
Yeah. It's scary, Art. It's like the Matrix. Only, you know, I should have not opted for the red pill. it's really, really strange. When you start looking at what's going on out there, so much of it just doesn't make sense.
Well, when your doctor's worried, folks, you ought to be worried. Usually doctors are quiet guys with great bedside manners, and they're telling you that all is going to be well and you're getting better. That's the usual line, right?
Yeah, and I don't want to cause people to be unduly concerned, but people need to be aware because something has to change, and it's going to take all of us. I mean all of us, because the leadership to make this thing happen, it's not going to happen from, you know, the guys who are in power. This has got to be a global event. People have to wake up and start taking charge of their own health care, their own health destiny. And, you know, our place on the planet, we have to be looking at a pro-life, pro-longevity, you know, stance.
All right, well, that takes us back to what the caller asked prior to the break, and that basically boiled down to a did George Bush do it question.
Oh, thank you, Art. I really appreciate that.
Well, he did ask.
He did ask, so let me answer it this way. I can only hope and pray that those men who are in control of our very lives are men of goodwill and humane conscience and are acting in the best interest of us all. May God protect us.
First time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Ronald Klatz. Good morning.
Yes. I want to ask, what kind of psychological profile is done on some of these biologists to make sure when they're going and do research that they're not harboring either some jihadist-type feelings or racial-type hatred?
My God, is that a good question? Yeah, I got it. I've got it, sir. Thank you. It's a superb question. When we send up space astronauts into space, rather, we give them a battery of psychological tests to determine they're not going to, likely will not go berserk once they get up on the International Space Station or whatever. So people working with these little horrors that we've been talking about, Dr. Klatz, are they required to pass any sort of psychological certification?
That's an interesting question.
Oh, it sure is.
I know to get into medical school, they put you through all kinds of psychological aptitude testing, but I don't believe there's any of that involved in PhD programs in microbiology, so I would have to say there is none to my knowledge.
Oh, gee. Okay. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Dr. Klatz. Top of the morning.
Hello.
Hello.
All right. As far as natural thinning out, right now we've overpopulated the earth enough that we don't have enough minerals in the ground to actually grow the crops to give people what they need to keep them healthy. The world is, as far as pollution and everything else, we're getting to the point where we're it's hard stretch to actually keep people healthy on its own.
Are you suggesting that the thinning out, or the culling, if you will, of the world's population might not be such bad idea? Is that where you're going?
In the long run, for the actual longevity of mankind before something, I mean, if you look at all other animals, any animal that overpopulated as much as we have would have been extinct a long time ago.
Uh-huh. All righty. There you have it, straight out, Dr. Klatz. Perhaps the world's population needs to be culled.
Well, it's a pretty hard thought, isn't it? That's really not it. You know, that's just so antithetical of, you know, those of us who have training in medicine and in the sciences. We're here to preserve life and to extend life, not to limit life. And it really doesn't have to be, because the planet will reach a maximum. The projections are the planet will reach a maximum of about 8 billion people, and then it will start to reverse if the technologies that are in play, anti-aging technologies, biotechnologies that will lead to improved health care, are extended globally. So the concern of the overpopulation issue with regard to anti-aging or even biotechnologies really, I don't think will come to be.
Yeah, but you just talked to a guy who thinks, and he sounded reasonably intelligent, obviously believes very strongly that a culling of the population is in order. So that kind of thinking, it may not be public a lot, but it's out there, obviously.
Yeah. Well, there are those who have suggested that the planet should have a few billion less people on it than it does today. I'm not a proponent of that, and I would hate to think that there are forces at work trying to consciously achieve that goal.
Well, I would think at the very least that people who would have that goal might not become, or perhaps shouldn't become, microbiologists in this modern day and age, or at least there ought to be a psychological test, as the caller mentioned, for people into that field.
Not a bad suggestion, Art.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Ronald Klatz. Good morning.
Good morning. I was curious about banned vitamins, in particular, vitamin I heard of in a book I read was D13, orotic acid. I was wondering if he heard of that one, and if there's a listing of various vitamins or nutrient supplements that are banned or under threat of being banned on his website.
All right. Doctor?
No, there's not on the website, but if you look up Codex on the Internet, they will. You can read about the levels that they are suggesting.
All right. That would be CODEX.
Right. There's a tremendous amount of information out there because it's being pushed very, very heavily by the European pharmaceutical companies. And the suggestion is that almost everything that's in the GNC or health food store down the block would be converted into a drug status.
Doctor, is this all for financial motive, in your opinion? In other words, you make things available only through prescription, and then you get a lot more doctor visits. Is that the motive behind this, or is there more?
I think it's an issue of global control. I think it's an issue of finance and global control. Alternative health care, and I don't really like the term alternative health care, but you know, people using nutritional therapies and managing themselves, their own health care, is in the opinion of certain factions in the pharmaceutical industry is not a good thing, and for every dollar that's spent on nutritional therapies, it could be construed as costing the pharmaceutical industry $10 to $20. In those countries where Codex is the law of the land, Germany and the Netherlands, a bottle of zinc supplements that would cost $4 here is now selling for $56.
All right. I get the idea. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Klatz. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
I really appreciate your discussion and would like your expert opinions on what I'm reading about nanobacteria.
Okay, I can hear you, but you're going to have to get a little louder. What about nanobacteria?
Well, I'm reading that two separate reports in the Journal of Proteome Research say that nanobacteria in rain clouds could be contributing to diseases around the world, and that nanobacteria have now been identified in humans on four continents.
Wow.
And I was wondering if you guys had seen that.
This guy hasn't. How about you, Doctor?
I have. Nanobacteria is still controversial. They're very small, vanishingly small bacteria that really shouldn't, you know, that don't really fit into the category of bacteria because they're so small. But they sequester calcium. And it's believed that they're the cause of kidney stones and maybe the cause of calcium depositing in coronary arteries, these bacteria, they're ubiquitous and they are calcium fixing and may be the underlying cause of some of these degenerative diseases of aging. And they're concerned about nanobacteria. Interestingly enough, NASA did a study on the growth of nanobacteria because in a weightless environment, they explode in their growth cycle.
But, Doctor, she just said nanobacteriological presence has been detected in humans on four continents. Good God.
Well, it's throughout people. The article she's referring to is they've apparently found nanobacteria in clouds. And that it's actually, it's actually raining down on
in
people.
In clouds now, how would nano...
But this is a natural bug. Just because it's called nanobacteria,
okay.
It's not something that somebody cooked up in their laboratory.
All right.
This has been in the environment for forever.
I see.
We've just discovered it in the last, 15 years or so.
And we're sure that what we've discovered is only natural?
Oh, yes, we believe it's natural. It almost certainly is because people have been having kidney stones and atherosclerosis for
forever. Yeah, right. Okay. Ma'am?
Well, thank you so much. And one of
it's
the
still
things
controversial, though. I don't want to say that it's absolutely for real. There's still some microbiologists who are not convinced that nanobacteria are, in fact, a separate class of bug and that they do everything that I've talked about, but that's the way the literature is leaning right now.
And thank you so much about mentioning Codex also. I wouldn't be able to talk tonight if I couldn't use quercetin for my sinuses.
Well, it's something that it will affect everyone's life.
Gee.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, bye.
And have a good night. Hello there, you're on the air with Dr. Klatz. Good morning.
Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
I'm calling from Columbus, Ohio, and my question is to the doctor. What can I do to protect my family and my children, specifically under the age of 3, from a chemical or biological attack?
Oh, boy.
That's a good question, actually.
It's a great question, but it would take someone who's more expert in NBC, nuclear biological
chemical,
than I am. The best thing you can do is keep your, that I can give you, my advice that I would give a patient is keep your immune system high. Do whatever you can to boost your immunity, and there are ways of doing that.
But having said that, and I certainly agree with you, a strong immune system is probably the best defense. He's talking about an attack, something as horrible, for example, as Marburg. Might as well face it, it could happen.
Yeah, well...
Sounds like you've got or somebody's got... Oh, I see. Okay, go ahead, caller.
Yeah. This is not my area of expertise, and if there is an attack like this, we're all in trouble because these biological agents are extremely lethal, and all you can do is try and get away from the area that has been released.
Yeah, I did ask earlier, and he said he'd put on a barrier, on his face, breathing, and get the hell out of town.
All right, so a tent or something like that wouldn't be a really good idea for a child. I should just pack your family up, get in the old station wagon, and hit the highway?
Well, it depends. You may not be able to get out. And if you can't get out, then building, rooms within rooms within rooms to try and limit exposure to, protect the, air and that sort of thing it would be helpful. With Marburg, specifically, all you'd have to do is make sure that no one came in contact with you, either by droplet or aerosol or by touch. And so I'd lock the door, and I would stay inside and try and weather it until it burnt itself out, because these...
Have you prepared yourself to do that?
No, I have not. I don't see Marburg as an issue for us in the United States, as an infectious disease risk with what's happening in Africa. But, of course, if it was to become weaponized and used against the public, that's a completely different issue.
Uh-huh.
In which case, God save us all.
Right. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Klatz. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning, Doctor. Good morning, Art.
Hi.
Hi. Just a couple quick comments and a question. Number one, I really do believe there is a cure for cancer, but the pharmaceutical industry is holding it back.
He just agreed with you, man.
Oh, excellent.
Hold on a second. If there's a cure for cancer, let's hear it.
Well, I mean, there's things that work right now. I mean, there are... we talked about the stem cells and with leukemia. There's experimental things that are working right now. There are people who get cured of cancer every day. 90% of all stage one cancers are in fact curable. Stage one cancer is when you've caught it about the size of a pea or smaller. You can cut that out or burn it out or freeze it out, and eliminate it, and it'll never develop into anything else. How many people go through the kind of cancer screening that would allow them to find cancer at stage one?
Almost none.
But if you don't die of cancer, you can add an extra 3, 4, maybe 6 years to your average lifespan. So there are things that we can do now, but I think the caller is talking about, you know, a more generalized universal cure, which I'm not quite sure is available yet, but and if it is, I'd like to know about it.
Ma'am?
Yeah, and also the other comment was, I was watching local news today, and they had mentioned something about finding some sort of cancer-causing agents in toothpaste. And I'm wondering what your opinion is on that. And also, I'll get my question done and hang up. Do you foresee in the future, along with stem cell research, some sort of booster shot you could take in adulthood, basically, like for a body cleansing? And that's my comment. And
okay.
I'll hang up. Thanks.
All right. You bet. Doctor?
Okay. Which one are?
Oh, I don't know. Whichever one you like. A general body cleansing, for example?
Well, I don't know that one shot is going to do that. I mean, your body cleansing needs to be done over a period of time, and you need to be doing it constantly, because we're constantly exposed to toxins in our environment. Water, tap water alone, is according to the EPA, is responsible for 30,000 deaths a year from kidney and urinary tract cancer. Okay, so, I mean, just the fluoride and the chlorides and the bromines that occur and the chemicals that occur within the water supply. The lady talked about toothpaste. It's been known for some time that some of the chemical agents that are used as preservatives and are used as different types of aesthetic agents in cosmetics might be mildly carcinogenic, and so the argument has been in natural health food circles is to use only natural products.
Doctor, we're out of time. That's it, buddy. We're done. We're way out of time. Thank you for being here.
Okay, all right.
You will be back.
World Health Net?
I say it again.
WorldHealth.net.
All right. Take care, buddy.
Okay, live long and well, Art.
Good night.
Good night.
See you all tomorrow night. We'll talk about consciousness and prayer and stuff. From the high desert, in the darkness, good night.
Midnight in the desert, shooting stars across the sky. This magical journey will take us on a ride. You with the longing, searching for the truth. Will we make it till tomorrow?